Accession number 30018, reel 7.
Well, your students faced at that stage, was it, I mean, is there a sort of, is it landing, or is it, or did people have different problems that they faced when they were learning to fly?
I think it's true that people do have different problems, but there are very few people that do not experience an I can't land problem sooner or later in their training. So I think probably the hardest thing for people to learn to do is to land properly. And I certainly, it must have taken me 5 years to learn to land. I mean, I had been landing all that time, and I only suddenly realised when I was on the course at DTPS that I now could forecast what a landing was going to be like just before it happened. That's the essential difference. Once you can do that, you have learned how to land. Up until that time, you're going through some sort of set of motions that result in a safe landing, but oh, that one wasn't quite as good as, oh, wasn't that lovely, you know, type of thing. They're all quite safe, so, but your variation is quite small, but nevertheless you weren't quite sure which sort you were going to have until you'd done it. Well, you might say, what makes the difference between being able to decide beforehand what the landing is going to work out like, or having to wait for it to happen? And the answer is, of course, how accurately you can perceive the rate of descent, how accurately or how completely you are aware of the speed of the aeroplane, the height of the aeroplane, the various instrument indications that can be used to help you, and so on. You either suck all this lot in and can process it in your head, and then a foot above the ground you know you've got it cracked, or you know you're going to land left wheel first, or whatever it is. Well, you can't. And when you are struggling, struggling is the wrong word, but when you're not quite so experienced and settled in it, you're a bit too busy to judge some of these things. We see it with a student person learning to drive a car, don't we? And there are so many similarities between driving cars and aeroplanes. People will be amazed, and I'm always banging on about them. I know that height control in a motor car is fairly easy, it just rolls along the ground. But you've still got to control its direction left and right, and you've still got to control its speed, you know, and fore and aft. And so there are issues. And what do we see with somebody who is learning to drive in lesson one or two? They're staring over the end of the bonnet. They would be oblivious to anything happening to the left or the right. And they're having so much trouble in just keeping the thing straight. Well, it's exactly the same with learning to fly airplanes. And after a while, you know, the mirror signal manoeuvre thing. I mean, you don't think Formula One motor car drivers are going through mirror signal manoeuvre, do you, when they dart about on the grid? So people do become much more speeded up. They become much more capable to hoist in all sorts of information that is there than when they're learning. And it's the same with aeroplanes.
So is that airworthiness like roadworthiness, in a sense, that's the thing that you learn, what's going on around you and how the machine's operating, without having to think about those operations?
I wouldn't use the word airworthiness. Airworthiness to me means, is the mechanical machine in a fit state to go and fly? Has it got a certificate of airworthiness? Has the 700 been signed up? I think what we're talking about is airmanship. Airmanship is this collection of skills used to describe what a pilot needs to fly. And I suppose roadcraft, or I don't know what the appropriate one is in motorcars, doesn't matter. But certainly airmanship is everything that you're trying to teach people. It's a very difficult term to describe. A lot of much more clever people than me have tried to describe what airmanship means over the years. It hasn't got anything to do with using the aeroplane for the job. Airmanship isn't about being able to aim the guns accurately or drop the bomb accurately. It's about flying safely. It's about flying Well, safely, I suppose. Safety. Flying the aeroplane effectively, efficiently, dealing with emergencies. It's all about airmanship. It's called airmanship. Today, with multi-crew aeroplanes, the term has become, which is about coordination between people in the crew, that there has started to come about a totally different feeling. They say that everybody in the cockpit has got some input to make. In the old days, the senior guy who'd been flying for 40 years and was the captain wouldn't expect some youngster who'd been flying with the airline for 6 weeks to pass comment. You know, in fact, he wouldn't have listened to him if he had. Today they don't see that. They see the whole crew coordination thing as being very important. And so that's a sort of multiple person airmanship, where this crew coordination is very important. And young, less experienced crew members are actively encouraged to comment about how the more experienced people are doing. So it becomes a team effort.
When you were instructing, were there pupils that you had who you would say had natural ability or who could fly very, very quickly and had those kind of skills at the start? Mm. And others, obviously, who were the opposite?
Sure. I haven't mentioned this, but I only did about two-thirds of my tour as an instructor before I got sent to ETPS. So I only had three of my own students during that time. And remember, we were at Cranwell, we're talking about permanent commission type cadets, people who've been through a fairly intensive selection process and training process before I got to see them. And so these were pretty high quality youngsters. I can remember one who was very slow to learn. I can remember one who, right at the other end, you only had to show him anything once and he just did it straight away, and then there was another one in the middle. Well, the one who was brilliant in terms of natural piloting ability, because that's what we're talking about now, any time I showed him anything, he could just do it straight away as well as I could. When he started going solo, we noticed that he was putting more time in his logbook than he was flying. Now, usually students did the reverse. If they flew for 54 minutes, you know, they put 50 minutes in the logbook. Because in general, students are allowed so many hours to pass the course. And so you normally wrote in, when you were flying solo, you would err on the shorter side. This chap was putting down an hour 10 when he'd done 55 minutes. Well, of course, the logbook stuff gave us an opportunity to interview him, and it became quite clear that this chap had no interest in being a pilot. He was a brilliant pilot, but he had no interest in it. He just wanted to be a service officer. Well, that may seem a reasonable thing, but it was an anathema, actually, at that time in the Air Force, and he was thrown off the course. He was somebody who wanted to go around with a sword and a uniform and a this and a that, and maybe he was a Walter Mitty character, that's it. Or perhaps he wasn't, but anyhow, his motives for being in the Air Force were not really acceptable to us, and he got thrown off. That left me with an ordinary student. Well, that's ordinary. One who had got average to high average ability, aptitude, call it what you like, and one who was struggling. Now, the one who was struggling, he used to bump into me when we were walking out to the aeroplane. You know, he's one of these people, when you walk, he sort of bumps into you as you're walking along. And we're going out to fly one night, you know, and I'd had trouble getting him to line up on the runway. And he was always off to one side or the other, and he seemed very late to recognise this. So we're going out for another sortie, he kept bumping. And I rather facetiously, I said to him, Adrian, I said, which side of the bed did your mother sleep on, you see? And he couldn't understand what I was on about. But anyhow, he struggled throughout the course. He was marginal. He had several flight commander checks. But I was totally behind keeping this chap, because from every other point of view, he was exactly the sort of young pilot you would like to have on a new squadron as the junior pilot. He was so keen. He'd do anything. He was, I mean, it was just all about motivation. And he would have been the perfect junior pilot on a squadron. And so we did. I mean, some people are slow learners. In whatever the field of endeavour, and they late developers is another term you hear used, don't you? Well, he was one of those. And however, he was sent onto the advanced course at Valley, which was NATS in those days. He got through the NAT course. I mean, you got to accept that this chap was safe. He was just at the bottom end of the rest of the course. If he hadn't been safe, we couldn't have persisted with him. But he was safe, but he was poor, you know, low average. A few years, some years later, I was at Dunsfold, and the Red Arrows came in, and he flew in one of the aeroplanes, and he was the Red Arrows manager. And he went on to become, you know, a brilliant aviator. So you do get, and then he became an airline pilot and so on. You do get people who are genuinely slow learners. But there's got to be, in the military, there has got to be some reason for persisting with them. Because they've got a bad mark against them, you know? You might say, well, if you can get the chap there in the end, isn't that all you're trying to do? Well, no, you know, the job that we want them to do in the Air Force is going to be a lot harder than fly a piston provost, or sorry, a jet provost. You're looking all the time in the services when somebody passes a course that is a stepping stone towards the full operational capability. You're looking for somebody who's got a lot in hand, or they'll have no trouble with the next stage. You're not looking for somebody, when he's this country at this stage, I'm not sure he's going to make the next one. You know, you can't afford to invest money in the services in somebody like that, because as you go through the stages, in this case, learn to fly aeroplanes, some of these later aeroplanes are going to be costing £10,000 or £15,000 an hour to fly. And that's why it costs them £3 or £4 million to get a bloke onto a squadron these days. You can't afford to chop people late. All the aim these days has to be, from a financial point of view, to realise the weak links early, or the weak students early, and chop them early to avoid a lot of investment in them. So that is the flying training conundrum. And you need very experienced people operating such a flying training system, the instructors and the standardisation staff, if you are to get the results you want out of that.
Because it sounds, as well as obviously the instructing of the flying aspect of things, that you need to make almost a character judgment as well within the framework of the programme.
Well, certainly the officer qualities bit and so on, yes, that's always there. One has to say that even in my day, and it's a long time ago now, the officer quality thing seldom gave trouble. I mean, that chap who was brilliant and got chopped, he was quite the exception that proves the rule, sort of thing. The Royal Air Force, as I say, even in my day, half a century ago, had a very good selection process when it came to officer qualities. And people very, very seldom got through this preliminary assessment net and were clearly unsuitable as officers. I suppose that comes from the ease with which an organisation can achieve that depends on two things. One, the validity and quality of their assessment techniques. But then next, the number of applicants that they've got. If you've got 20 applicants for every slot, you can be very choosy. And certainly in my day, that was the situation. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of pilots, people who wanted to be pilots. And so the Air Force could be extremely selective for the few slots it had in who they chose. So no, we didn't have a great deal of difficulty with that.
And you say that you didn't complete your tour because you got your...
Yeah, I went on with
pilot's course.
Sure.
Well, how did that come about? Why was that?
Well, I mean, I've been trying to get to ETPS, you know, since my first Hunter Squadron. There were two things that got in the way of it happening. When I left my first Hunter Squadron, there was the issue of, you haven't got enough flying hours. I had, I think, 620, and the minimum was 850 or something, that on the paper minimum. And then I was sent on a winter survival course, and I had a skiing accident and did a cartilage in my knee. And that cost me my medical category. So this is while I'm an instructor. I had lost the A1G1Z1. A is the air grading, G is the ground grading, and Z is the international grading. So if somebody suffers from malaria or something, then they'd be Z4 or something, you know, got to be left in the UK or I'm not sure of the actual details. G was whether you had to be protected from certain ground things. And A was your airborne type thing. Well, because of my knee, I think I was A1G3 or something, because I'd now got this weakness in my knee, which meant that in certain circumstances on the ground, I might have twisted it again. There wasn't any problem with flying airplanes. So I hadn't got the medical category to get to ETPS now, and so there was a sort of side issue where I had to struggle with the docs to get my medical category back. But eventually I did, and so I got interviewed at ETPS, which was fairly much a formality because I'd passed all that stuff at the end of my Hunter Squadron. They just were concerned that I hadn't got enough flying, and I got some more flying. So I was sent by ETPS, once they had decided they were going to take me, to Manby, which was meteor training school, to do a meteor conversion. And this was the fag end of 62. I think it was sort of October time, 1962. My course was going to start in 63. I've been an instructor at Cranwell for 61 and first bit of 62. And so they sent me, I left Cranwell and was sent to Strubby as a student to get some twin engine jet experience before putting me on the course at ETPS, because there were several multi-engined jet types on the course. So that was what I did, and off I went then to Farnborough.
What meteor were you converting onto? Was it
the 7, yes. We had two-seaters, an unpressurised two-seater. And so, yes, I was checked out on those. It's interesting that we've come to the meteor. I think that CFS, world leader though it may have been, in terms of setting the standards for flying instruction in around the world, they weren't perfect. There was a period in the early 50s where I think their philosophy, the CFS philosophy, which was then pushed out into the squadrons and implemented by the standardisation units, flights on the units, you know, how the training system is supposed to work, was wrong in respect of asymmetric handling on Meteors. The Meteor, being an early twin jet, was capable of being flown at the same speed on one engine as on two engines when you were coming into land. If you want to think about it from the practical point of view, the wing is the same, the wing provides the lift, therefore why shouldn't you land as slowly as you do when you've got two engines? Well, the problem was that at the normal speed for landing, on one engine, you had a very difficult task to keep the airplane straight, because there's an engine on one side that wants to make the airplane go sideways, and so you had to use a lot of rudder. And if you got yourself the slightest bit low on finals, you would have to use twice the power on the single engine to get you back onto the glide path. And this was also going to be pushing you from one side. So it was very easy to let that engine push the nose right round. One wing went forward, the airplane went, rolled over on its back, and in it went. So students were being required, in my view, incorrectly, to fly the same speed on one engine as they did on two. In my view, they should have flown 10 knots faster, which raises the possibility that you might not stop on the runway and will go trickling over the grass at the far end and get bogged down, sort of thing. But goodness me, does it matter if you go off the far end of the runway at sort of bicycle speeds compared to roll on your back half a mile before the runway and go in fatally? So there was a very bad period when, in my view, the CFS macho thing of it is possible to fly this aeroplane like that, therefore you will do that. I can do it, you will do it, blogs. That's not too clever in my view. And I've always had my, as I'm sure plenty of other Irish pilots have, had my own personal ideas about CFS, but I mean, they're the only two issues that I ever had with them. I thought we should land a bit faster on one engine, and I thought that you should control speed with the throttle before it was generally accepted.
Again, what were your impressions of the Meteor? Because at that stage, it had been in service quite some time, hadn't it?
Yes, this is 1958. This is 1962. It must have entered service 10 years earlier, I suppose. Although the airplanes that entered service then were the sort of Mark IIs and Mark IIIs, and they'd gone to the Mark IVs, and then we had the Mark VIII. Different engines, different tails, and so on. No, it had been developed. I thought it was a lovely airplane, and I flew Meteors throughout my test flying career at Bedford. We used them as communication hacks. We used them for investigation of thunderstorms. We used them for turbulence flying. We used them for a variety of jobs. And lovely aeroplane. The ones we had, I never flew a Meteor with an ejector seat. None of them had ejector seats. But it was a very tough, strong aeroplane, and I think you felt you could put it down in most circumstances.
Did it have any vices?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking of an aeroplane designed in the late 40s, and my word, aeroplanes had plenty of vices in those days. Today designers know how to design aeroplanes without vices, but they didn't in the 50s. And the particular vices of a Meteor were that if you had the air brakes out and the undercarriage down on the downwind leg, you could lose longitudinal control, and the aeroplane went into what was called the phantom dive, where the nose would go down and backstick would not pull it up, and the only thing that you could do was to put the air brakes in. I mean, you weren't supposed to have the air brakes out when you put the undercarriage down. You were told to put the air brakes in first, but inevitably some people made mistakes. So yes, it had the phantom dive vice. It had the very difficult, physically demanding, I mean, I'm talking footloads of 300 pounds, physically demanding single engine control issues. All that went away with later designs of aeroplanes, yeah.
So you've converted onto the Meteor, so you've got your twin jet engine time.
Mm-hmm.
What was the next stage at that point?
Off to ETPS. And ETPS at that stage was at Farnborough. And I was married by now, and so I was put into what was called a hiring. And that was a bunch of houses that were rented in the local area for married officers, as opposed to the staff, married students, as opposed to the staff officers who were in married quarters, which was a patch of houses devoted to the staff. So I was allocated a hiring in Closeworth Road in Farnborough, and we drove there, I don't know, generally the something or other, and it was a very hard winter, the winter of 62-63, and the snow went from the front gate in the front garden up to the windowsill of the bedroom on the first floor. So we literally had to tunnel our way into the... but anyhow, it was a hard winter that winter. But, you know, so what? You just you come to do the course. So you just dig the snow away and get on with it. The course was great, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think most of my contemporaries... I was on 22 course in 1963. Most of my contemporaries had a bit more trouble with the ground school of the course than I did. But now, at this level, my background of being an apprentice and being taught some of the basic subjects, as well as all the practical experience I had as an apprentice of Farnborough and a flight test observer, was invaluable in terms of making it easier for me to handle the course.
Were they having problems with kind of the technical or the aerodynamic side or that sort of
thing? Yeah, that's right, yeah, the ground school. Yeah, sure. I didn't have that trouble, and I mean, it had to be mastered, and some of it was refreshing, some of it refreshing stuff I'd done in the past. The odd thing was new, but my workload in ground school, nothing to do with the flying, because we had an hour's ground school lecture every morning at the start of every day. My workload was lower than the rest of the guys, and so I could put more effort in and thought into the flying side. So,
at that stage, were there any of the other chaps who were doing it who had serious problems getting their heads around the ground?
Oh, I think so, yes. Nobody was failed, but, you know, some of them were really struggling. I think one of the things that one was never sure of was what the sort of pass-fail level was on ground school. I don't actually, and again, I've no idea if this is correct, I don't actually think that there was a fail mark. I think it was desirable that people did as well as possible on the ground school, but providing they could fly the aeroplane successfully, providing they could write a good flight test report, that, after all, was their job. But they were still going to be better test pilots if they could talk to the boffins or the engineers in their own language a bit more, pass on their experiences and issues. So I think it was a big bonus to do well in the ground school, but I'm not sure that it was a pass-fail thing. But that's interesting. I've never even asked... I'll ask one of my tutors, because I see him fairly regularly still, Eddie Rigg, and I'll ask him whether they did have in those days a fail thing on the ground school.